Florida has the sunshine. West Virginia has the coal. Virginia was the home to eight presidents. Louisiana brings the soul. And they always play funky old soul, singing joy to the South. Sing and move your mouth now. Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Tennessee. There's North Carolina, South Carolina too. Arkansas is where Walmart got its start, and now our song is through. Sing joy to the South. Sing and move your mouth now. Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Tennessee.
Welcome to Flavor Living Radio. This is Bryant, your host. And you know, it's early part of September. Did you guess what our show is about today? Yes, we are going to the South. Yes, below, you know, Virginia and below, you know, Kentucky, Alabama, Florida, North Carolina. Last week we were in the Midwest. We were talking to Catherine Lambert, and she kind of told us, you betcha. I had to say that, you betcha. She was telling us about the Midwest, and this week we go to the South. And we have on our show today a special guest. He's a food historian from North Carolina. His name is Rick McDaniels, you know, and he kind of really breaks down and tells us what happened with the foods and the history of foods there. And there's a lot of great history there, you know. So we're doing a series. We're traveling around the U.S. and outside the U.S., but here in the U.S. first. And we're going around and showing history about different regional food. We're today, we have to go to the South with football, good food, country food, soul food, you name it. It's there. Cajun, Creole, all this food is there. And we had to visit and find out more. I'm amazed. I learned and learning a lot more as we're doing the regional shows. First, we have to go, and we found some people. They were trying out foods in the southern region, in the South, for the first time. And we had to let you guys hear this. So you can hear what happened on their taste test here. So, all right, here we go. We'll be back with our interview, but you got to hear this first. All right.
I'm really excited for sweet tea because I feel like ladies like sweet tea, and I've always wanted to be a lady.
Oprah or okra?
What's okra?
So this is okra, dude. It's
okay, I thought it was an animal.
It looks like a banana pepper. What are they called? Pepperoncinis?
Why don't you like okra?
It's so slimy. It's disgusting.
Yeah. I love a good pickle. What's this, a little peanut?
Yeah, a little peanut.
Little peanuts?
Ooh, it's slimy.
I don't like that it's wet.
It feels like a bean.
It's salty.
I like it a lot.
I am pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm. I'm not gonna lie.
Liver mush.
It looks like burnt toast.
A weird brownie. That's what it feels like.
It smells pretty good.
I'm not mad at it. Maybe it would be good with like ketchup or like a sauce.
Yeah, it's like a sandier cousin of the hamburger.
I could see myself cutting open one of these biscuits, putting it in there.
Can you give us like 5 minutes? I just want to finish eating. Country ham.
Country ham.
Country ham.
It's not your typical deli ham you see in the supermarket. This is like ham.
It's like a hug from the Lord. It's delicious.
What would happen if I replaced my morning coffee just with this gravy?
Oh, here's something that tastes good. I know what we'll do. We'll soak it in butter and gravy. Oh, you're a genius.
Oh, it's a moon pie.
Who needs something this big? There's like 3 cookies in one.
Looks like a s'mores on steroids.
Oh, can I take this with me?
It's probably the thickest cookie I've ever
had.
It's
a lot to bite into.
I could see like every third grader in the South like just having one of these in their lunch boxes.
Is this something where I'm like, oh, I like this. Is this the best thing I've ever eaten? No, but like if you try to take it away from me, I would kill you.
I think all Southern food feels like it's prepared with love.
I think there's something to be said for this food in moderation.
You're worried about your artery.
California needs to step it up a little.
I know. We're like, everything we're doing is like, how can we add kale to it? Give me this sugar ham.
Yeah.
I think Southern food makes you happy while you eat it, and then right afterwards you're like, all right, nap time.
And then you're happy while you nap. Then you wake up and you're cranky, and then you just eat again and you're happy.
Okay, here's our interview in North Carolina with Rick McDaniels.
And we have a guest today, an author, a food historian, anthropologist. His name is Rick McDaniels. He has two books out. We want to welcome Mr. Rick McDaniels. How are you doing, Rick? How's it going? Welcome to Flavor Living Radio. How's it going?
Doing good, Brian. I appreciate you having me.
Wow, so you're in North Carolina, correct?
The old North State, as they call it.
Ah, I gotcha. Yes, I used to. Now, you know, I guess what happened after college, I still had a military brat or military son in me, so I traveled and lived in Myrtle Beach before, South Carolina.
Huh.
Yeah, so
yeah.
So I did some travel. I guess it was still in me, you know. So we're here to talk about the food history of the South, the Southern region. And you have two books out now, one is called An Irresistible History of Southern Foods and Asheville Foods, A History of High Country Cuisine. Wow, two books.
Yeah, it's sort of a really trip to think that I've written two books.
Yeah, are you like amazed a lot? You're like, well, I wrote two books?
Yeah, I mean, writing a book is something that most people just dream about doing, and, you know, to have actually sat down and done it is sort of beyond belief sometimes.
Oh, my girlfriend, she's an author, too, and we had to go through that experience as well. So I know a little bit about that, but as far as, you know, she's a new author. So, and you've already completed two, so that's awesome. Tell us about, a little bit of history. I thought I wanted to start off. I want to start off from where you were raised, how you were raised. You said you were brought up in the Carolinas.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Kings Mountain, North Carolina, which is a little town of about 7,000 people in the 1960s. I like to tell people that Kings Mountain was a lot like Mayberry, except we had a couple more cops and a couple more drunks.
Okay.
Our police department literally had the Mayberry police cars with the big old antennas in the back and the red bubble gum machines on the
wow. Road. So everybody knew, like, if you got pulled over or speeding, you're like, hey, how you doing? How you doing, Scott, Ralph? How's it going? Like that.
Oh, man, it's true. I mean, my father was the city treasurer, so I literally knew every single police officer in town.
Wow.
And I knew which, my best friend and I literally would keep track of which cops were on duty which nights, because we knew how much we could get away with the police set.
Wow. So basically, y'all had fun. You had fun. You had some good times.
Oh, yeah, it was a great place to grow up.
So, now, you, as far as cooking and cuisine and a chef, you have lots of generations, or you grew up with a lot of generations of chefs and cooks in your family?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I was really lucky to come from a family of some really awesome cooks, some ladies that were just really magicians in the kitchen. My mother was an only child, so I really didn't have a lot of, I didn't have any aunts or uncles. I had great aunts and great uncles, and these people, you know, had grown up on farms, and they were just masters of cooking and canning and preserving and all that stuff.
So you learned from the real rooted, some real roots there.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to go. I was looking at as far as the Carolinas and everything, and I saw that you really liked Louisiana a lot. You really dig the Creole and Cajun foods there.
Yeah, I was really lucky. I went to college at Western Carolina University,
okay,
which is in a beautiful mountain town called Cullowhee, which is about 60 miles from nowhere. I mean, there was literally nothing up there in the 1970s to do except if you were lucky, you got three channels on the television.
Yeah.
And one of the ones that we got was public TV. So mm-hmm. I was able to, on the afternoons, I would watch, on Saturday afternoons, we would watch Justin Wilson and his Cajun cooking show.
Yeah, I remember him. Yeah. He was there. Yeah. I mean, I'm telling on myself, but I remember, you know, looking at, yeah, seeing that, you know, some of his.
Yeah, Justin was a trip.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a trip. And, you know, we had no money because we were college students and we had to spend it on beer and other substances.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, we were always looking for a cheap meal, and Cajun cooking is the food of the poor, so it's, you know, kind of like French soul food.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, we would get to watch the show and then hightail it to the supermarket and get the stuff and come back, and I would make what he had made that weekend, and that's how I taught myself, you know, Cajun cooking.
Wow. That's unique. Now, you know, I was looking at, you know, I'm from Virginia, as you know. I was just kind of explaining, I'm from Virginia. And,
mm-hmm.
and Jamestown, I'm from Hampton Roads, and Jamestown is not too far from there. And
mm-hmm.
that's where it all kind of started, right?
It did. Jamestown was really where Southern food was born. And we sort of do a disservice to. History is one of the things that is so poorly taught in American schools. It's ridiculous. Everybody hears Pilgrim, Pilgrim, Pilgrim.
Yeah.
Jamestown was way before the Pilgrims. Pilgrims didn't come until 1620. Jamestown was 1607.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really there where Southern food was born. You had the food of the English when they came in. And they had to adapt because a lot of the ingredients that they had, they just did not have here in America. So, you know, instead of having wheat bread, they ended up with cornbread because you could, you know, you had to have a lot of cleared land to grow wheat, and you didn't have to have very much at all to grow corn. So you had the Native American influences, and then, you know, starting in 1619, when the first Africans came to America, you had their influence that combined with the English and the Native American, and it just sort of made a melange of wonderful flavors.
Wow.
And that's pretty much how Southern cooking came to be, and it was just refined for the next 400 years.
Now, so Native America really, they taught us a lot of things. They taught us what they and many other cultures. But I saw that people learned the different, corn was a major thing, and you had stated that when people learned these different techniques and new foods away from the coastland, they were able to move inland and move away from mm-hmm. Virginia, you said. Some state of Virginia,
yeah,
a lot of people moved away, he said.
Yeah, after they started moving away from the coast, the food started to get some further influences. For instance, in western North Carolina, where I live now,
mm-hmm.
There was mostly Scotsmen settled there. So they brought a whole different twist on food. They weren't trying to recreate the English manner foods that they had in the plantations. They were more of a subsistence culture. So, you know, you had things like the country hams that are much a part of mountain food. Their sugar was just non-existent, so they were growing sorghum, and they would have sorghum syrup instead of sugar, or honey to sweeten things instead of sugar. Really up until the Civil War period, sugar was ungodly expensive, and you just didn't have anybody except the uber rich using sugar.
Now,
the Scots were much more attuned to following the Native American food ways also. You know, the Native Americans came up with the way, with their way of growing corn, where they had what they called the three sisters, where you would have corn, beans, and squash all grown together in the same patch. The you know, the beans would trellis up the corn, and the squash would provide shade so that it didn't burn up in the sun. And, you know, they would use a fish, a dead fish, in the hole where they planted the corn to give nitrogen to the soil. And it was just, you know, sustainable agriculture 400 years before we thought of sustainable agriculture.
Yeah, and you were saying, it was saying that the Scots and the Irish and the Cherokee, and those two really got along as far as, you know, they were like a couple, you know, as far as a lot of marriages between the two cultures.
Mm-hmm.
They were really pretty.
Yeah, the most common surname among the Cherokee Indians, and they prefer Indian instead of Native American, mm-hmm. is Ross. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of Scots in there. You'll see a lot of Cherokees that have red hair and blue eyes also.
Yeah. I understand.
Do you have the Soggy Bottom Boys performing Man of Constant Sorrow?
No, ma'am. We got a new shipment in yesterday. Sorry, but we just can't keep it on our shelves.
Welcome back to Flavor Living Radio. Woo! We got to go back to our history teacher for the South, the Southeastern region, Rick. Yes, we got to go back, learn some great history, some good details. Let's go back.
Talking about, I wanted to ask about this phrase, the Columbian Exchange, and Christopher Columbus. Because, you know, after the Jamestown and everything, we come mm-hmm. with Spanish, right? You said?
Yeah, the Columbian Exchange was a really fascinating thing. Basically, what happened was when Columbus, quote, invented, end quote, or discovered, end quote, the New World, which how can you discover a place where people are already living?
But you're saying, when they say the term New World, we were here.
Yeah, I mean, there were already people here. I mean, there's some debate as to whether the Chinese or the Vikings discovered America, but, it was way before Columbus. But anyway, just as with everything today, as soon as he, quote, discovered it, end quote, it became a geopolitical football, and you had the French, the Spanish, and the English, and the Catholic Church all trying to get in on the action to get as much money out of the deal as they could. Mm. And one thing that the Spanish did was they had been on ships for months and months. So when they were on these ships, what they ate was pilot biscuits, which is kind of like a big old soda cracker, except as hard as a rock. And water that you've heard the term grog, that's basically water with rum in it to kill the germs. Mm. And so when they got off the boats, they were ready to eat anything that didn't try to eat them first. So they saw all the foods that the natives were eating and went, hey, let me try some of that. And so what they did was, well, they found these foods and they ended up taking them to different parts of the world. And that's how you have tomatoes, which are native of South America, as an integral ingredient in Italian cooking. The peppers in Jamaican cooking, those come from the in Thai cooking, they come from the Caribbean.
Wow.
Potatoes are the major thing that kept the Irish alive through the 16th, 17th, 1800s. You know, they come from the Peruvian Andes. So all these foods, the Swiss chocolate, that comes from in Mexico.
Really? Because when you think of Sweden, you think of Swedish chocolate, you think of really? Wow.
But, all this stuff was completely unknown to Europe until the Columbian Exchange.
And you had stated that oranges and peaches came from China? Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, and it was so interesting because the Native Americans had this creation myth, this whole creation myth about peaches, and they had forgotten as a culture that the Spanish brought them. Unfortunately, that was because the Spanish also brought smallpox and other European diseases that almost wiped out 90% of the Native Americans in the 1400s. But they had just completely forgotten that peaches hadn't been there the whole time. Yeah, the entire geopolitical thing with Britain and France about who was going to end up controlling North America just happened to tip toward the English because the Spanish decided that they were making too much money mining gold. They weren't really going to settle. And then, the English had success at Jamestown. And it was really in the balance there for a while. Southern food could have been tamales and tacos.
But, I'm thinking I could just see Columbus on the ship. He's like, man, the world doesn't even have a clue about these foods, y'all. Let's try. I know they had great, great meals on that ship, because they, sailed at different, like you said. They must have some great meals. So, and how I was wanting to ask, Rick, I have some kind of like some words I wanted to kind of throw at you, and then you just kind of say word association. All right, you ready? Are you ready? Are the Carolina? All right.
I'm a little nervous.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, put on the seatbelt.
Here we go.
Ready? Okay. Iced tea.
The nectar of the South. That is like the what babies are weaned on. We go from the breast to sweet tea down here.
Okay.
And the way that you can tell if somebody's really Southern is we don't talk about sweet tea. We just talk about tea.
Right.
And it's automatically known that we're talking about sweet tea.
Right.
And my wife, God love her, we've been married almost 25 years now. And even though she was raised in Athens, Georgia, she was originally from Indiana. And the first time I went to her house and poured a glass of tea and took a big gulp, it was completely and totally unsweetened, and I almost choked.
Right.
Without meaning to, I sputtered south, damn Yankee tea. And I guess she had a good sense of humor.
That's why I mentioned the first word was I see. You see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next word. Wild game.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Wild game.
Wild game?
Like hunting.
That is a very important part of Southern cuisine because, you know, we're rednecks down here. We like sheep stuff. And especially in Louisiana, man, those people put anything in a pot down there.
Right.
It don't matter if it, as long as it don't slither back out, they'll put a lid on and cook it. There's a lot of, when you're Southern, especially growing up in the 60s like I did, everybody hunted.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just a given. And there was always rabbit, there was squirrel, somebody would bring you some venison that they got that weekend. And it was just a really big part. It was a big part, you know, especially for folks who didn't have a lot of money. It was a way to put meat on the table.
I've had some venison before when I was in college, so I like venison. So it's really, you know, I like some good game meat too as well, you know. So,
mm-hmm.
Okay, our next word, here we go. Fish and shellfish.
Every Southern boy goes fishing with their dad. I mean, it was just a rite of passage. I've got a buddy that has a 6-year-old son who caught a 60-pound catfish a couple of months back. He said that he went to show and tell in first grade, and all the other kids were doing PowerPoint presentations, and this kid was talking about the 60-pound catfish he landed. Fish is really one of the reasons that we're still here, because when the Jamestown colonists came, that was the worst selection of people that found a colony on that you could possibly have. They were complete and total idiots when it came down to it. They had no clue. And for the first year, they pretty much lived on fish and shellfish that they got out of the James River.
Mm-hmm.
And if it hadn't been for that, they would starve to death. But fishing, you know, is a huge part of Southern food. I had a big bunch of fried catfish last night, and I was in heaven.
Okay, our next word is cobbler.
Cobbler. All of our desserts come from England. And cobbler is just one of a huge, when I originally wrote, you know, what it is for those of you who are still cobbler virgins, is a fruit pie that is made with biscuit dough that instead of being rolled out and made a sheet like a pie, you drop it by spoonfuls in there and it gives the look of a cobblestone street. So hence the term cobbler. And, you know, my grandmother's blackberry cobbler is one part of my childhood that I still think about all these years later. It was so good.
Oh, my mom's peach cobbler is the best here. Oh, man. Yes. Cobbler is really good. Our next word, I'm trying to see here. Our next word, let's see. How about, you know, as far as, you know, gardening and vegetables?
Gardening and vegetables are huge in the South. It's really an art that is going away the more we get, as much as we get urbanized. but it's coming back in terms of farmers markets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The people in the South have always been huge into gardening and preserving, especially in the days before you could just run down to Publix or Whole Foods and get whatever produce you wanted. You had to grow and preserve the produce you were going to live on through the winter.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm thinking too, like you said, as far as Christopher Columbus and the Native Indians, because everybody has to thank the Native American Indians for teaching everybody how to do this, how to cook, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Certain things, you know.
If it hadn't been for them, we would have starved to death.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that the Jamestown colony survived. It is really a miracle.
Wow.
A lot of it was the fact that they were taught so much by the Native Americans in terms of how to grow their own food and how to store it and how to preserve it.
You know, those guys are like, we have to tip our, we really have to give them, the credit, you know.
Yeah.
I was going to mention two more items on our word association things, but I stopped.
Okay.
I was going to mention gravy. I had to put gravy in there. Yeah, I had to say gravy.
Yeah. Well, this morning, I've got to point out that I don't eat like a Southerner all the time. I was in bed years ago. But it just so happens that Friday is the one day at work that we stopped by the Tasty Diner, and that's TASTEE, which has been there for, God, I think 65 years now.
Yeah.
They have the best biscuits and gravy on the planet.
So remember, everybody write it, because I'm writing it down too. The Tasty Diner. It's in Asheville.
Yep.
Asheville.
On Haywood Road.
Okay.
So, when I can't get in the parking lot next Friday to get my biscuits and gravy, I'm like, oh, I should have kept my mouth shut.
That is our word association. That is, you really went through those. You went through those words like water. So that was awesome, Rick.
What do I win, Alex?
You win. Biscuits and gravy.
All right.
On the house, son. Every Friday.
I have that in a new car.
Yeah. Now, one more real quick. You have a second book out about Asheville foods. And I was amazed at just looking at the words that you wrote just at the beginning of the book and talking about the Vanderbilt House in mm-hmm. Asheville, North Carolina. I didn't know. I know, from living in the Carolinas, I didn't know that this house was there in Asheville, North Carolina.
Wow. That's kind of amazing, because I was interviewed by this guy from a magazine in Australia one time, and he goes, Asheville, eh? I said, yeah. He goes, that's where the bloody big house is, isn't it? I'm like, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, can you tell everybody about this house? I like the rooms, the bedrooms.
This is
where you live.
Biltmore.
Yes,
Biltmore Estate is the largest private residence in the United States of America, and it has 250 rooms, and it is what's the technical term for it? Frippin' huge. And if you ever want to see where Downton Abbey really was, take the servants tour of the Biltmore Estate, because you'll think that Mrs. Hughes is going to pop around the corner at any minute.
35
if you were,
bedrooms? 35 bedrooms.
Yeah, 35. There's like 35 bedrooms, it's 35 bathrooms.
Bathrooms, okay.
Or something. Yeah, 35 bathrooms. I mean, it's just, it has its own indoor swimming pool, it has its own indoor bowling alley. It's just amazing how we just really don't have an idea of what wealth like that was like.
Yeah.
Except from, looking at the houses.
Say that again.
Wow. I mean, even Bill Gates doesn't have a house this
night. Yeah, that's what I said. I mean, you can say that again, man. Daniel, thank you for being on Flavor Living Radio. Now, you have a website. Would you like to tell everybody? Are you working on your third book? Or can you tell everybody about your website?
Sure. If you want to learn more about the Ashland Food Book, you can go to ashlandfoodbook.com. If you are interested in Southern food history, my website for that is hushpuppynation.com.
Okay.
And my recipe database is at www.chefrick.com.
I mean, hushpuppy.com, that's a good name right there. That's a good name.
Yes, hushpuppynation.com.
That's a good one. It's a good one. Well, man, thank you for being on our show and educating us on, you know, the foods from the southern region, from the south. And
thank you so much, Brian. It was a blast.
Yeah, this is, wow, you did educate. I'm like, all right, now, you want to give us a word from the south? One word? A good word?
A good word from the south?
Yeah, like a good southern.
Let's see.
Good south region.
Let's see.
Word. Yeah.
The southern word is jeet. J-E-E-T.
Jeet.
And the way you use it is, jeet yet? No? Well, let's go down to Tasty Diner and get some biscuits and gravy.
There it is. Jeet. All right. Well, thanks for being on the flavor.
All right, thanks.
That was our show here on The Flavor. We hope you enjoyed Rick McDaniels. He's got two books out. You got to check those books out. He knows his stuff. He should teach in college, in high school. Have books for students to, learn about history of the southeastern region. We should learn that in school. But listen, thanks for tuning in. Eat well and drive safe. And happy Labor Day on Monday. So happy Labor Day, and tune in next week. And we're going to have more Taste and Tell. I have more from Hope Foods and some more surprises for you in our coming shows coming up. All right. Have a good week on The Flavor.
Now it's time to listening to Flavor Living Radio.